And as we pass the 10-year anniversary of the war in Afghanistan, we want to check in today on the National Guard, which has been stretched thin fighting that war. Unlike active duty military, guardsmen and women live at home, not on bases. They're known as weekend warriors, training a weekend per month. And especially during the Vietnam War, there was a whiff of the draft dodger about the Guard. But today there's no draft, and half the U.S. fighting force in Iraq and Afghanistan is National Guard, many on multiple deployments. 1 in 10 troops killed in action since 2001 was a member of the Guard. The suicide rate has increased, and a study found that in the first year after fighting abroad, Guard members develop PTSD 29% more often than active duty military. So, we're going to hear from a guardsman, but first let's get this big picture on the Guard from retired regular Army Colonel Bob Killebrew. He's a senior visiting fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He joins us from WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia. Colonel, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's nice to be here.
Just fill out more what the sense of a guardsman was, you know, especially in the Vietnam era.
Well, I'll start very quickly at the very beginning. The Guard is the oldest component of the national defense. They actually started before there was a country, back in the French and Indian War days and even before that. The Guard always has fought in American wars. In the Vietnam era, President Johnson made a decision early on not to mobilize the Guard. Although a couple of Guard units actually did deploy, the bulk of the Guard missed that war and acquired, in the regular Army at least, a kind of a flavor of people with influence and pull who stayed in Guard units to avoid combat service. And it was unfortunate. There was a real split between the Guard and the active Army, the regular Army, during that period that took a while to heal. That began to heal in the stresses of the 1980s when we had large Guard supplements to an overstretched military even in those days.
And I want to just mention one other thing because we're going to hear from people. There was another wound that needed to be healed. In 1970, then-President Nixon sent the Guard to Kent State, to a college campus where there were student protesters. And, of course, students were killed by equally young guardsmen. And so that was a wound that needed to be healed as well. But, you know, it brings us up to 2001, and, you know, there was real shock on the part of not just people who knew guardsmen, but guardsmen themselves, that they might actually see combat.
Well, that's true to a point. Now, going to war is a shock for everybody, but you notice that when the Guard was called up for it, they all showed up. By the 1980s and 1990s, we had professional guardsmen, just as professional in the cycle of being a guardsman as regular Army people were in the profession of the full-time Army.
Difference is, of course, they lived at home.
A guardsman lives in three worlds. First of all, he's a soldier. He's never as well trained as a regular is on a day-by-day basis, obviously, because a regular dedicates all of his life to it. But the guardsman learns as much as he can with as much intense training as he can get in the time that the law allows, which is normally 2 days a month and then, of course, the 2 weeks in the summer. But even so, the leadership and people in leadership positions usually spend far more than they make in their guard pay going to extra unofficial training just so they can stay on top of the job. So that's the first world they live in. The second world they live in is the world of the state. Guardsmen who have done strenuous tours in Iraq and Afghanistan turn around and be mobilized for tornado duty or flood duty or things like that. The third world, of course, is the world of their civilian life. They have families, they have children, they have jobs. So to be a guardsman or an Army reservist, I might add, is tremendously taxing in ways, curiously, could be more difficult than the regular service.
Is this maybe one of the reasons why there is a higher PTSD rate in the Guard than the rest of the military?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. I'm an old soldier. I have the Vietnam experience. The people who stayed in the Army after Vietnam were in far better psychological shape than those kids who did their duty, got out immediately, and went home with nobody to talk to. A guardsman might see intensive combat. He'll go through his demobilization period, but then he's back out there on the street among civilians who have no ability to understand what he's been through. It can be terribly damaging.
Well, but the Guard is now being presented as a money-saving alternative. The Guard is said to be 35 to 40% of the operational force of the Army and Air Force for less than 7% of the budget because you're not maintaining bases and brick and mortar for them.
Well, that's true, but remember, that's also at a much lower level of expertise normally. The United States made a decision a number of years ago. We deploy the regular force, and the Guard comes along behind it. And that means that it takes time for that guard force to be trained up.
Members of the Guard have been on multiple deployments. They're supposed to be called up once every 6 years or so, but for some members of the Guard, they've been deployed much more often than that. You know, that may be a problem for their families, but actually, as I say it, it sounds like maybe that is what maybe can ratchet them up to the level that you're talking about.
That's correct, and we probably have the best-trained National Guard today than we've ever had since World War II. But a level of training that you get for a prolonged deployment, like, say, a year in Afghanistan, doesn't continue when you get back to home station. By the time they roll around again to deploy again in 2 years, they'll have to go through another retraining session.
Well, but what do you make now of reports that we're reading that the Guard is now seen as low investment, high return, sort of a part-time business model, and a business model that's working that could maybe help offset some of the costs of the rest of the military?
The economy argument always comes out during times of budget stress. It goes back a long way, and as dollars get tight, there's always a strain between the services and between the Guard and the active force.
What about the impact of the increased use of the National Guard on the towns and states that they are also supposed to defend? I'm reading a report from the House Armed Services Republicans. 10 years of war have reduced National Guard and Reserve preparedness for the full range of missions and ability to respond to domestic disasters as recently as a year ago, and this is a 2011 report. Governors had less than half of the National Guard equipment on hand to respond to hurricanes, floods, wildfires, and other crises.
I wouldn't be surprised to ask the Republicans to pass some taxes to buy all that stuff.
That's Bob Killebrew, a retired Army colonel and a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security, saying what? We need to invest more money into the Guard? Because right now, a lot of the payment for Guard materials is through earmarks.
Well, that's true. But disaster relief equipment and stuff like that can come from other sources, FEMA and other organizations, and the states can work that. One avenue the Guard has always had that the regular Army doesn't have is to go through their governors and through their congressmen direct to the Congress for allocation of funds.
What other purpose do you think the Guard serves? It strikes me that post the draft, a lot of Americans don't even come in contact with people in the military, but with the Guard, you know, you do. They're in your community.
I heard a wise gentleman say once that if you want to have support for national defense, give me a National Guard armory in every community. I think that's correct. I think one of the things that we all as citizens have to think about carefully is what a key role the Guard plays in being the bridge between the regular force and the citizens on the street.
Bob Killebrew, retired Army colonel and, again, senior visiting fellow at the Center for a New American Security. Colonel Killebrew, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
Today we're looking at the National Guard. We just heard some stats. The Guard has a higher rate of PTSD than regular military. They also have a higher than the national average joblessness rate among members of the Guard who've served since 2001. What are some other issues? Well, let's bring in 27-year-old Staff Sergeant Jay Winkowski. He's been a member of the Iowa National Guard since 2004. Now he's planning to leave in a year or two. A big change, because unlike the other weekend warriors who have civilian jobs, Jay also works during the week for the Iowa National Guard, rendering military honors at funerals of Iowa veterans, sometimes three or four a day. Sergeant Winkowski has seen plenty of combat. He's been deployed twice over the past 7 years, first to Iraq, where his unit was deployed for almost 2 years. That was the longest of any unit in the American military in the Iraq War. And just this past July, he came back from 12-month deployment in Afghanistan, where he led a six-man reconnaissance squad. He joins us on his cell phone from Nevada, Iowa. So, Sergeant Jay, that combat, right away you put aside the old Vietnam-era notion of the Guard as refuge from fighting. If I may ask, what kinds of combat did you see?
The situation we went into was pretty much a nightmare scenario in the sense that the enemy owned every inch of terrain and they regularly conducted ambushes on coalition forces. And so right away, we were basically thrown into intense combat almost every time we went out.
Yeah. You were surrounded and outnumbered three times. You and other men made it out okay, but a member of the Iowa Guard was killed. So this is not your father's Vietnam-era Guard.
No, that's right. People join up with the Guard these days. It's not a matter of if they're going to deploy, it's a matter of when. That clock just resets every time we come back, and it's just a matter of time before we go again.
Well, and you told us that as recently as 2004 when you signed up, it was more if you get deployed, but that's really changed.
Yep, that's right. Well, you know, when I first got in, some guys were still joining for college. You know, they were pretty hopeful that a deployment was going to happen to them. And, you know, that all changed, you know, starting in probably 2005, 2006, when, you know, the Iraq war really picked up. The military really started leaning on the Guard to fill those shortage gaps.
Do you think the Guard has leaned on maybe a little bit too much now? We hear talk about states that didn't have equipment to do their domestic job, you know, defending against extreme weather, which is part of the Guard's job. They didn't, you know, have backhoes and things that had gone off to war. And then, you know, we also just heard about the high rate of PTSD because you guys come home and you're separated. You're not, you know, you're not together anymore. So talk about those two things. Do you think there's too much pressure on the Guard?
Yeah, well, there's kind of three different things there. The first one is equipment. When I first got in, we had riot gear at the armory that I was at.
Yeah.
We had snow chains for the Humvees. We had some other types of equipment for disaster-related emergencies. And now when you go into the Army, everything is so combat-focused. Everything, we're always looking at that next Afghanistan deployment, that next Iraq deployment. And, you know, disaster preparedness has kind of fallen by the wayside.
What about the PTSD portion of this? Explain how that is so different. I mean, it would make sense. You come back as a unit, but then you don't go back to a base. You go to separate homes.
No, that's right. And that's why you're seeing the elevated levels among the National Guardsmen, I feel, is that while we're over there and we're going through these, you know, intense combat experiences, we rely on each other for that, you know, network of support. And when we come back home, we lose that network. We lose that support. You know, we spread out into, you know, all the corners of the state. I come back to my small town, and I'm the only one that has had that type of experience.
And yet you've chosen the Guard over the military.
That's right. And I've seen that the Iowa National Guard, my unit, has outperformed our active duty counterparts. When we were placed in Iraq, we were placed by a parachute infantry regiment from the 82nd Airborne. Our expectations were these guys are going to be super soldiers. These guys are going to outshine us in everything. And it just wasn't the case. They were blown away on our capability, our level of training, our quality of soldiers.
Well, and you're going to leave, and we should rush to say it's because you have a child now and things are different. I mean, is that why you've chosen to leave the Guard?
Yep, that's right. I'm looking at not deploying anymore, basically. You know, I love the National Guard. While I was a scout squad leader in combat in Afghanistan, there was nothing else I'd rather do, you know, in the whole world. I love that job to death, and I would do it, you know, every day if I could for the rest of my life. But the simple reality is that, you know, I should have been killed over there. You know, plain and simple, I should not have made it back, given the intensity of fighting that we saw. And if we just keep doing that, you know, someday I won't make it back. You know, biggest priority is family.
Well, do you worry, though, do the unemployment stats give you pause, the high unemployment among returning military?
Yeah, that is a concern, and that's something I do see also, you know, amongst my soldiers. It's hard to translate that experience of, you know, leading soldiers or being in combat. It's hard to translate that to civilian skills.
Well, you might have something else going for you, Sergeant Winkowski. Because as you prepare to leave the Guard, we understand you're receiving a special award from Army researchers for inventing the Iron Man pack. Do I understand this loads a rifle directly from the pack?
Well, what it does is it feeds ammunition from a backpack that the soldier can wear into a machine gun. And it allows the soldier, you know, an immense amount of firepower without having to reload. It's something we came up with while we were serving in Afghanistan. And we showed it to, you know, active duty Army, and they really liked it, and it went off from there.
Well, congratulations. Maybe there's something in, you know, along that line for you, you know, when you look at your next career. That's 27-year-old Staff Sergeant Jay Winkowski, a member of the Iowa National Guard. Sergeant Winkowski, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.